that's really an elementary example. It's a standing complaint that judges, in interpreting the statutes, consider not what they were in, not so much what they were. They don't pay. I don't want to be libelous, but the criticism is that they don't pay sufficient attention to the intention of the draftsman, but see the thing through their own distorting lens, through the and therefore they produce wrong results. I don't know how far I've seen that criticism made in books, of course you say unorthodox legal books, and I can well believe that it's well founded. I can't say from first-hand knowledge, naturally.
Despite this empirical approach, would you say that in the end precedence dominated?
In the end, what?
Precedence.
Yes. It's the line of least resistance. Uh-huh. And you see again, a precedent has got the idea of authority.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I see. You would say then that both at provincial headquarters and in Colombo there was a tendency to preserve the status quo.
Oh yes. I think that probably applies to every organized, every government on earth. I think that is the tendency.
Would you put this down to lethargy, in a sense, you know?
I suppose so, though I don't think it's fair to say it without qualification.
Yes.
I don't think that laziness was an outstanding trait, but I think that when a man has got as much work as he can do, his tendency to take the line of least resistance or to follow precedents rather than thinking out for himself.
Yes.
I think it's a temptation that's almost irresistible. I'm quite sure I've succumbed to it thousands of times.
Yes, what I meant was lethargy when it comes to trying something new with a view towards improvement.
Yes. Yes, that to a certain extent, plus the knowledge that anything in the nature of innovation will be ill-received above, and quite likely, when he's gone to a great deal of trouble, it'll be turned down.
Yes, I met Mr. Newnham, and he made the point that Ceylon was a senior crown colony, and the government had reached its peak, and wanted everything to be as quiet as possible.
Quite so. That is the thing that I meant to say, and I'd add to that the colonial secretary and the old regime. He expected his next move to be to a governorship, and therefore he wanted peace in our time.
Yes, he made the same point himself.
And there's another thing about colonial rule in general. A governor, in the nature of things, can't know what he's doing. He cannot know the knowledge of the country that's necessary for him to be a really wise, benevolent despot or anything of the sort. He's compelled either to take the advice of the senior people on the spot or else to face their obstruction.
Mm-hmm. And
I'm not saying active obstruction, but they're saying, oh, well, old so-and-so, he always knows better than we do. What's the use of wasting time telling him the facts? He knows. Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
I can quite understand people taking up that point of view. I don't want you to think that I'm damning them for doing it. I think that's human nature. I think the fault lies in the system.
And again, Mr. Newnham felt that he was in Secretariat for just a short time, and he felt that many of them were just what he called writers of clever essays.
Of course they were. Because that was what was asked of them. You see, if I tell you that if you write clever essays, you'll be rewarded for it. If you go and do things or think for yourself, you'll be put in your place as thinking that you know better than your superiors and so on. Mm-hmm. Well, what are you going to do? After all, you're not in the service for the good of your health. You've got your living to earn. You've got your future to consider. And sooner or later, you have to consider your own interests.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's a cynical statement. I think that's again, I think it's a fault of a vicious system.
In this sense, the system was such that it was obstructionist, was it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It comes back to the old thing that it paid better to do bad work than to do good. When I say bad, I don't mean work of inferior quality,
but in the wrong language.
The wrong type.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that there was a tendency to seek, both in the field and in the center, there was a tendency to seek efficiency as an end in itself, without asking why are we doing this?
I'll plead guilty to that myself, but I don't think it was a common fault.
Uh-huh.
Looking back on it now, I can see that I was certainly doing that on occasion.
Uh-huh. And taking overall policy, wasn't there a lack of drive and purpose in British rule? Because
yes, there was.
Mm-hmm.
I should say.
Why? Because they never asked the question why.
Well, why is the most unpopular word in the language.
Mm-hmm.
And you ask a question why, and you don't get an answer. You get the thing, well, do you think you know better than? When I was first in the country, I was struck by a penny cultivation. First of all, by its beauty. I can remember, I saw those terrace penny fields at Elba, just when they were at their best. I'd never seen anything quite so beautiful in my life, not in that line. But I asked two questions about penny cultivation. The first one was, is paddy an aquatic plant, that's to say one that derives its nourishment from the water, or is it a land plant that merely wants a great deal of water for its efficient growth? And the second thing is, if it's a land plant, why is it that you can grow paddy year after year on the same land, perhaps for hundreds of years, without the land rebelling and refusing to support it? And I thought, I mean, candidly, I suppose I was extremely innocent, but I thought that when I asked those questions, that those were the things that people would have and would say, well, good heavens, didn't you know that?
But they didn't.
They didn't. They were furious at me for asking them.
This is the people or the civil servants?
Civil servants. As a matter of fact, later on, I got the answers. But more by chance, when I had certainly I lost the original keenness or interest.
For personal interest, I would like to know the answers.
Well, paddy is a land plant which requires a lot of water. If you go on planting the same plant in the soil year after year, they found by planting wheat at Berkhamsted, you don't find that the land refuses to produce that, but it gets down to a low level and there it stops. And the paddy in much of Ceylon had got down to that state, but it was producing a quite uneconomic yield and was being planted, though, for social reasons and for reasons of custom. The second thing is that though it gets its nourishment primarily from the soil, it can benefit a great deal from the water. And Barnes Rough Water, De Sau, who died not very long ago, told me that near Ballyhull Oyr, he pointed out the watershed, and he said that the water on this side of the watershed produces nourishes the crops and you get a much better yield than you do the ones just the other side. And when I say the watershed, there was just a line of demarcation with paddy fields right up to the watershed on each side. And I saw in a popular science book one of the explanations, namely that you get an organism called a blue-green alga, which has two properties. One of reproducing itself extremely rapidly, so that if you put one plant in today, you'll have the water infested with it tomorrow, so to speak, and that fixes atmospheric nitrogen. And the article that I got, I've got it in this house, only I think I could put my finger on it, said that in certain parts of India, this made a very great deal of difference to the paddy yields. Mm-hmm. So there was the answer.
I see.
But I stumbled on it by the merest chance.
Yes. In the 1920s, did you come across or have any opinions of the governors, Manning, Clifford and Stanley?
Well, Clifford, of course, was mad before he came to Ceylon, and it was a scandal. He was a man. He was a very great man in his way, and it was absolute cruelty when a man like that suffers from incipient insanity, as any one of us may, to send him to a place where he can make a public fool of himself.
Yes, I see. So in effect, was the colonial secretary in charge, or could he not control Clifford?
He couldn't control Clifford, and he hadn't got the guts to, and he would have got no thanks from the colonial office if he had. You see, it pays to do bad work rather than good.
Yes.
If he had done his proper duty, he would have cabled to the colonial office, and the colonial office would have remembered the warning they'd been given by King George V.
Uh-huh.
Which Newnham has probably told you about.
Whereas Bowes has written a book.
Mm-hmm. And something might have happened, but the colonial secretary would have had a black mark against him, saying, oh, he's one of these people who gives trouble.
Clementi, that was, wasn't it? Well, he was certainly there in the early years.
I can't even remember whether it was. I think he had gone, you know. No, it wasn't. It was Fletcher.
Fletcher. Mm-hmm. Somehow I haven't been able to put a finger on what sort of man Stanley was.
He was a son of entity.
Mm-hmm.
Curious thing, a stupid Jew.
Oh, he was. certainly someone else, I think. Sir Franklin Jimson said that he was a mediocrity.
No, just made no attempt to govern. He was.
Wouldn't you say that this was what Mr. Newnham says, the fault with policy at this time. It would just drift, and there was no direction from the centre.
Yes. Hmm. But then you see, we get back to the fault of the system. That you had the system threw up people at the centre who were not in a position to guide, or if they did guide, would be likely to guide wrong,
uh-huh,
through ignorance of the country.
Uh-huh. What I felt about many of the secretariat personalities, some of whom I met here, was they are very much stereotyped sorts who moved in fixed lines, very conservative.
Oh yes, then you see that paid.
Uh-huh.
Well, you see, it comes both ways. They were that was the type of person who was wanted for the CSO, and therefore they were picked, hand-picked. And being there, they found that to indulge their own bent brought them into favour. Naturally, they continued it. I don't want to.
It's
a vicious circle.
If I may turn to a completely different sphere, yes. I'm very interested in land, you say, and land policy.
Yes.
Was there any land policy in the 1920s?
No, there was never any land policy.
Mm-hmm. Now, there were two, we may call them policies, there were two desires. A, to sell land, of course, and make money, to planters and capitalists. B, to conserve the land in a native peasantry.
Yes.
Where did the balance lie between these? Did they think it out at all?
No, it was... I should say that a good many people were barely conscious of the conflict, and those that were, some inclined in one direction, some in another, and nobody had really got the power to control them.
Yes.
You see, until the land commissioner's job was created, land policy was left entirely to the GIA.
And
when he was appointed, many of the GAs resented intensely any attempt to curb them, and the land commissioner did not carry sufficient authority to be able to say this has got to be done.
Oh, I see. So, in effect, even definitely in the 1920s and even in the 1930s, policy would vary according to the different GAs.
Oh, yes. I mean, the dear Senanaka was the first man really to try and lay down a policy, but he was, of course, feeling his way, and he had got other things to do besides. But to get that policy enforced was quite another matter.
Mm-hmm.
And to get it enforced without a major row, if it came to a row, you would be damned merely because you created trouble, quite regardless of the merits of the case.
Yes, I see. Before going on to your work as a land commissioner in 1931, do you know anything about the work of the land settlement department in the 1920s?
Very little, and I only saw where it impinged on me, and my impression was that it was exceedingly badly done. Now, I'll put Worsley. I was talking to him about the, when I was quite young, I was talking to him about the land settlement department because I rather thought that it would be an interesting thing to go into.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I've been in there twice. He said, I was there once, not under Fraser, but when Fraser's memory was still fresh, and then it was an honour to belong to the department. And he said, now it's just a picnic. And I should say that it deteriorated considerably after he made that remark.
Mm-hmm.
C.O. Wickramasinghe, as land commissioner, was put in to act as settlement officer in addition to his other duties. And though he was not a strong man, I mean not strong physically, even though he died prematurely, and he was not neglecting his job as land commissioner at all, he cleared up an immense volume of arrears, just in the land commission, in the land settlement department, just in his spare time.
Yes, I see.
I tried to get the job of settlement officer, as you probably don't know, and I was told nothing doing.
This was in the 1920s.
No, in 1945 or 6.
Told by Drayton.
Huh?
By Drayton.
No, I went to see Senanaka about it, and I think that the Drayton would have stopped it in any case, but Senanaka said that it was essential to have somebody there who got experience of the work of the department. Well, I knew who told him that, and I was not in a position to argue it, but my own point of view was that you wanted somebody in there who regarded the tradition, instead of regarding the tradition of the department as sacrosanct, exposed it to constructive criticism. There was a department, in my time, if ever one, there was one that was run by precedent. And though they were obviously making a mess of things in lots of ways, that was sacrosanct. Anyone who defied precedent was setting himself up as knowing better than Fraser, who probably would have damned what they were doing out of hand.
Yes, I see. In the 1920s, when I was wondering whether, according to the precedents as followed, this land settlement department's tendency, inclination, when it came to this conflict between planters, Ceylonese or European, and village land, whether their policy was one of placing the European near enough to influence him, but not so near, influence the villager, but not so near as to dispossess the villager?
I can't say. The sort of thing I noticed was rather different. How long they took over the settlement of a village, and how, when they had done the immediate settlement, there was an enormous amount of mopping up to be done, during which they wouldn't keep an eye on the village themselves, and objected to letting the GA do so. The result was that by the time the village was released, which might be years and years afterwards, there were encroachments on Crown land all over the place, and the GA had got a major job on his hand clearing them up, which he probably didn't do.
Yes, I see.
What I suggested, I admit that I did it with my tongue in my cheek, but still I think there was something in it. I said if I were going to arrange the work of the settlement department, I'd do this. In the first place, I shouldn't make an expensive, detailed, landmarked survey of the entire village. I'd maybe make a proper survey of the village boundaries. I'd then send a surveyor out into the field to make a plain table survey, which can be done in 5 minutes, almost, just tying it up to those fixed points. And I would send out the assistant settlement officer with him, while the surveyor was parceling up the land. I'd make the ASO make preliminary inquiries, and as a result of that, he would find that a great deal of land which could be brought under the settlement of Orleans was just not worth the expense of doing it. It would be much better socially and financially to say, all right, let the villagers have it. It's valuable to the villagers. If we sell it to the villagers, we'll get, shall we say, 1,000 rupees, and it will cost us 20,000 rupees to establish our title in order to hand it on to the villager. Well, at the end of the survey, when the plain table survey was complete, and I should have troubled pretty much, I've really had a number of blueprints run off from the field sheets. This is quite practical from a technical point of view. And I said, well, now just let's consider how much of this is just not worth pursuing, how much of it is certainly Crown land and is required in public interest, how much is doubtful but still is worth pursuing, either because of its intrinsic value or because of its value to the community, steep hillsides and so on, and how much is just not worth pursuing. And I should have tried as far as possible to avoid selling land to villagers to be paid for by installments. Supposing you're going to sell a man 10 acres to be paid for in 10 installments, I'd say no. For the first installment, we'll give you 1 acre, and we'll give you a right of a preemption on the rest, exercisable within a certain time. Then release the village. You could release the ordinary village within a year. From the time the surveyor set foot in it till the time of its release, you could do it all in a year, and the only expensive landmarked survey would be in my time called the demarcation surveys. That's to say, the surveys embodying the final results.
Mm-hmm. I see.
They lacked all sense of proportion. The Crown's claim is worth enforcing, and therefore. The Crown has a claim, and therefore it must be enforced regardless of the cost in money or the social value of it.
Of the land, yes. And also, from the point made by you and earlier findings, I feel that what was wrong was that they didn't go out into the field with the surveyor, but they went on their own.
And another thing is, they used to come back to Colombo every month, or whatever it was. I should have said, stay on the land until you finish that village. Don't let me see your face until you've got the thing in your pocket. And it would have been done then.
Yes. your experience of this settlement was Brahmapura, Kudnagala?
Well, when I was in a district, I used to see the work that they were doing. When I was in the Land Commissioner's office, I used to see fragments of it.
Yes.
The things would come up occasionally.
Regarding the 1920s again, did some AGs at least, and GAs, try to prevent the villagers selling their own lands to their own detriment by any method they could use? You find these villagers selling lands to capitalists?
They always frowned on it, but I don't think there was anything they could do about it. And I can't call to mind anyone who really made a serious attempt to stop it.
Certainly in the early turn of the 20th century, the turn of the century,
yes.
Several of them asked for a law of non-alienation, you see, a sort of strict stipulation. But
how can you enforce it?
Well, in other colonies they've had this law saying that simply that no villager can sell land, his own land.
Well, could they enforce it?
Well, presumably they did try to enforce it. It would have had some effect, if not.
Well, I don't know. I'm always rather sceptical about
such laws.
Yes.
So did you, in your experience, find that villagers were sometimes selling crown land which they had encroached on to speculators?
Yes, but I was the real heyday of speculation was over by my time. In Ratnapura district, it was notorious that had gone on, and the names of the people concerned were well known. But I don't think it was real. The real harm was done by them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anything could have done very much.
Can you recollect any names
of
these speculators and buyers?
Well, the man who was always quoted was a man called P.D.G. Clark. And why it sticks in my memory, I can't tell you. I never met him.
Would you say, however, that despite all its faults, this land settlement department and its officers did its best to protect the villager from this sort of thing?
I think it did, but I think its ideas, that his methods were wrong, and that it didn't achieve this result.
Oh, you didn't think they succeeded in keeping the land, conserving the land in the peasantry?
I don't think so, really. I don't know about more recent settlements. They may have done so, but there's a thing at the back of my mind. No, I can't remember it. If I recall it, I'll let you know. I can remember cases where things have worked out. The difference between theory and practice has been very, very great.
Great, yes. Well, that's
now, I'll give you one case. This happened near Ambulantota.
Mm-hmm.
A headman owned a certain piece of land, and there was a bit of crown land, or presumed crown land, adjoining him. He was quite content, as I suppose, that it should stay in its present condition, but if it was going to anybody, he wanted it to come to him.
Mm-hmm.
And as usual, as you get in these villages, there was his enemy who was determined to have it just to spite him.
Yes.
The headman got a promise of it from the AGA. The other man got a promise of it from the settlement officer.
Yes.
And I saw a good deal of the correspondence years afterwards, and the settlement officer, or at any rate, who is the spokesman of the settlement department, may not have been the head of the department, to my amazement, because I knew him personally and I was surprised that he should take up such a line, he wouldn't consider the justice or reason of the thing. He was talking about the prestige of the department. It's necessary for the prestige of the department that it should be sold to this other man and not to the headman. So eventually the Ceylon government, in its wisdom, put it up to auction. And the headman had to pay through the nose for it. Well, that was still rattling when I was in Hambantota in 1924, I suppose 23. And Egan, who was the each year they succeeded. Even the AGA was impressed by the injustice of it, and he tackled Olympus on the subject. And he came back to me, he should not have repeated it, but he was so boiling over with rage that he couldn't contain himself. He said, "You know what so-and-so said to me?" He said, "Yes, of course I dare say the headman has been rather badly treated, but still as he's a headman he won't dare to sue the government, so what does it matter?" That was a very senior official who said that, and that was raised again when I was in the Land Commissioner's office first, and old Seminato was a minister, and I put that down in a minute, which I may say I destroyed afterwards. But at any rate, Serenaka saw it, and he did something I think he let the man off the remainder of his pay, of the money due. I forget what he did. At any rate, he did something.
There were a lot of... Would you say that there was a class of land brokers among the Ceylonese?
I've always been told that there was, but I've no first-hand knowledge. I should think it's very likely.
And these Ceylonese planters and land buyers, were some of them lawyers and proctors?
Yes, they were.
Mm-hmm. Many?
I should say quite a number, because proctors have told me that in the course of their business, they came across land with a very perplexed title. They'd had to straighten it out in the course of their business, and therefore, knowing the ins and outs of it, they could buy this up, whereas otherwise it would merely be a subject of a dogfight.
Yes, I see.
Now, I'll tell you what... by the way, we're going out for lunch. I don't know... What time do you want to get back?
I'm in no hurry at all.
No, what train do you think you're catching?
Well, frankly, I meant to.
This
most scandalous case.
Yes, I've never come across.
Mm-hmm.
This was a Pallewella in Sabrugawa. There was an apothecary stationed there. He was a man who came from the Low Country, from Umlangola, I think. And he started buying up land claims. You were speaking about Ceylonese land brokers. That made me think of it. I'd meant to tell you in any case. He started buying up claims. You know, any villagers will sign a piece of paper.
Yes.
Quite meaningless.
Just by a farm?
Yes. Well, he retired, and he settled in Pallewella with his sons. And with the connivance of the police sergeant at, or inspector at Rakwana, he proceeded to set up a reign of terror there. When he thought that the villagers didn't understand that he meant business, one of his faction, I'm not sure whether it wasn't one of his sons, murdered one of the villagers in broad daylight in Gorikawela Bazaar. He was, now, the year of that, I can tell you, because I was in
October 1924.
Yes. No, this was when I was GA.
Oh.
It was brought to my notice by the DRO, Aluwihare, in the beginning of 1950, and it had happened 2 years before then.
Yes.
Must have happened almost in my time then. Anyway, the man went up to the Supreme Court on trial for murder. I've had the record of the case in front of me, so I speak from first-hand knowledge. There was not the slightest provocation, there were not the slightest extenuating circumstances. It was proved to the hilt by the evidence of eyewitnesses, was committed in broad daylight. The police asked for him to be treated leniently. They managed to square the Attorney General, and the judge let the man off. For an unprovoked murder, he was put on probation for 2 years. That's why I remember the two-year date. And it came to my notice 1 month before the 2 years had expired. I got hooked. The police, first of all, denied all knowledge of the case, and Aluwihare ferreted it out for me. I got it from the district court, or magistrate's court, or wherever it was, and there was the record of the thing. He was bound over to be a good behaviour and keep the peace, and to come up when required for judgment and sentence any time within 2 years. Well, he had, during those two years succeeding this, he had been establishing a real reign of terror, driving the people by force off their lands. You know what Candian villages are like, and sticking to their land. I couldn't make out why people from Paliwella were appearing at Kaltota asking for crown land there, having left the land they were brought up on. At any rate, he was carrying a reign of terror, is the expression that Alawahara used, and I can't improve on it, and that was done with the connivance of the police in Rakwana. I couldn't, I tried to get this raised before the Supreme Court so that the man should be had up for judgment and sentence, but I failed. And before I retired, I happened to run across Alawahara, the IGP, and he mentioned this case, and I held forth, I'm afraid, in Queen's House, and I used somewhat immoderate language to him. I said, well, it's not my country, it's your country, not mine. I thank my stars, I'm not going to live in it if this is how things are going to be run.
Couldn't they transfer the man, policeman, at least?
They wouldn't.
The police?
They wouldn't.
So that means the IGP was ultimately responsible for this case.
He was probably worse than responsible. He probably knew and hadn't got the guts to do it. Mm-hmm. I can remember a comment by a Ceylonese politician on one of Fletcher's more outrageous doings. Somebody said, oh, I suppose Fletcher was bribed. Who knows, said this man. It was far worse than that. He just did it out of sheer stupidity.
Mm-hmm. And this, of course, had to do with land, yes. The point I was trying to get at about this land speculators was that I have a very strong suspicion, and there is some evidence, that this political attack on the land settlement department and on British land policy from the turn of the century to the 1920s, I have a feeling was partially motivated by some speculators who are also politicians, who have been hindered by the land settlement department.
I haven't quite got you. You mean the opposition to the land settlement department?
Yeah.
I believe that's correct. But on the other hand, I think that the land settlement department rather asked for it by overstrictness.
Oh, I see. But I'm not implying that all the politicians who attacked this land policy were speculators, but there appears to be some evidence so that some of them were also landlords.
Oh, yes, I think some of them were. But if they had got an eye to the main chance, the fact remains that there was quite a large amount of substance in their complaints, and that gave force
to their claim.
Yes.
What would you say was the substance?
That the settlement department was pursuing the letter of the law rather than justice.
Mm-hmm.
Ordinance 12 of 1840 said that that Chena and other lands which can be cultivated only after intervals of several years are presumed to be the crown, except on proof of a sonus or of a grant or sonus for the same, together with satisfactory evidence of the boundary thereof, or proof of customary.
Yes, I know. Proof of customary.
Yes. Well, the point is that if you take that literally, nobody can establish a private claim to Chena land.
Agreed.
Some of the settlement officers stretched that quite a long way. Some of them stretched it only a little way. Some of them didn't stretch it at all. But it was justice was the length of the Chancellor's foot.
No, but I thought that their tendency was to try and protect the villager from this. And after claiming the crown land, claiming it as crown, the land which the villager wanted, sell it to the village at a low price, but where it was a speculator, sell it at a fair price.
Yes, but you see, the one thing the villager hasn't got is ready money.
Mm-hmm.
And selling it to the villager meant selling it to the speculator. The villager can only afford the ready money by pledging the land to the speculator.
Oh, I see. Did they in fact sell it afterwards?
That's my belief. Mm-hmm. I can't, I mean, belief and bias, but I think that happened in a surprisingly large number of cases.
Okay. So then, really, there's nothing to prevent the intentions of the land settlement department being completely undermined subsequently.
There was never any, because once you've parted with the ownership of the land, mm-hmm. the owner is free to do what he likes.
That's my basic criticism of British policy, was mm-hmm. And Ceylon, though yes, of course, they tend to think that this law may not have achieved anything. I think they should have had a law of non-alienation.
Yes, in that particular case it might have worked, but the amount of supervision and so on, well, but fundamentally, unless you're going to give the land to the villager on terms that he can meet, it's no use.
Giving it to him because he can't develop
If you want ready money, he can't provide it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's another thing about the settlement department. You know, in the northwestern province in particular, they had what they call a tisbamba. The area that was to be kept clear around the village.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the settlement officer, when he was settling villages, he kept Tisbamba as crown land. Yes, but that was a straitjacket. If the village flourished, it increased in population, they wanted more land. Oh no, Tisbamba is sacrosanct.
Oh, I see.
And so they just crowded in on one another, forming a sort of rural slum.
Couldn't they be allowed to encroach into Tisbamba and another Tisbamba created?
That was the obvious thing, but no, Tisbamba was sacrosanct.
Yes, I see.
And how I came across it was, I came across when I was in Putnam. I couldn't do much about it. That is the solution that I should have recommended, but my opinion would have carried no weight. I couldn't have got anything done, and I'm afraid I thought I'm tired of bashing my head against a stone wall. Now look here, it's time for us to be moving.
At this point, the original spool was reversed. The interview continues.
What was the villagers' reaction to this land settlement officer?
What was
the peasants' reaction?
I don't know.
Did they grumble at his work, for instance?
I have no evidence that they did.
Mm-hmm.
I think, as a matter of fact, that they accepted all sorts of things from the government, or just as the act of God, and there's no use complaining about it.
Karma.
Mm. Yes.
What I was trying to really get at was, I was wondering whether these politicians who were leveling attacks at government, while some of them may have been doing it with an eye to the main chance, their own.
Yes.
I was wondering whether they were reflecting a genuine feeling of grievance among the peasantry.
I don't know. Do you remember years ago when reforms of the government of India were proposed? Montague, who was the Secretary for India, talked about getting the Indian villagers out of their pathetic contentment. It may have been like that. I don't know.
As for these politicians who were themselves land speculators, can you remember the Koreas?
The Koreas have got that reputation. Whether they deserved it or not, I don't know.
What about Incognagra? I was wondering about Madhavela, was it?
Incognagra? What was his name?
What about H.L. de Mel?
H.L. de Mel had got a bad name, but I've got no first-hand knowledge.
Mm-hmm. This is just a bad name among civil servants, or in...
Well, among Goyana's Sinhalese.
Oh, I see. But he was an upper-caste member.
He was Karawa.
Karawa, yes.
But I was on very friendly terms with at one time, that was Sinhalese, Gurigama, who used absolutely to rage when the name Damel was mentioned. Any one of the Damel family, he could hear no good of.
How did government decide which areas they should settle and which areas were just left unsettled?
Well, they had half-yearly conferences on the subject. The settlement officer was, I believe, took the initiative by keeping a sort of general eye on the country, and he had his own ideas of what to go forward with, and those were modified to some extent by the GA's opinions.
I see. So, was this land settlement work continued in the 1930s and 1940s?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It was still going on when I left, when I retired.
Oh, I see. And what were your own duties as assistant land commissioner?
Well,